Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, DX12, Ryan's benchmarking, OCC SSDs are back. Should you buy Dell XPS 13 tested AMD AM3 motherboard from MSI? All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
It's time for Twit's annual audience survey, and we want to hear from you. Please visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It only takes a few minutes, and your anonymous feedback will help us make Twit even better. We thank you so much for your continued support. twit.tv/survey.
This is Twitch. This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 308, recorded March 26, 2015. OCC is back. Kind of.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Are you looking to upgrade your IT skills or prepare for certification? IT Pro TV offers engaging and informative tutorials streamed to your Roku, Chromecast, computer, or mobile device. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itpro.tv/Twitch and use the code Twitch30. And by Harry's. For guys who want a great shave experience for a fraction of what you're paying now, go to harrys.com. Get $5 off your first purchase by entering the code Twitch when you check out.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most helpful, and occasionally most controversial news in hardware technology. Joining me today, and in a rush, and I got to say with good reason, because his beloved team, is that North Carolina? Duke.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's it. It's pretty close. You got the right colors, at least, or close.
I went there because I'm like 2,700 miles west of you right now, and I'm brave or stupid. I can't remember which. In any case, Kentucky is advancing. I understand, not being a particularly talented basketball enthusiast myself, that Kentucky may take it all and is, in fact, last I heard, favored to win the tournament.
Favored by a lot. They're still undefeated. There's a lot of stuff on the table here this year. So yeah, pretty excited. Decided not to go to the games. They're actually up in Cleveland, which is only about 3.5-4 hours from me. Now in favor of, if they make it to the Final Four, going to that Indianapolis, which is just 2 hours away. So they need to win two more games for me to be able to see them play again this year. So that's what we're hoping for. One tonight and one Saturday.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think you all join me in wishing Ryan and Kentucky the best of luck in their tourney. Yeah, oh my goodness. Exactly. I tease you, but your passion, I admire it, dude. You get so excited.
I do.
And it's pretty fun to watch. oh my goodness. It's been an interesting week. If I look like I'm agitated, it's because my beloved Windows 10 Pro technical preview, which has been a rock and flawless right up until this last update. And of course it's beta, shouldn't be running it on a production machine, but I have, because if you're going to be into it up to your neck, had some interesting build flaws. I think I actually now have functional audio possibly on the onboard of my laptop on the Dell XPS 13, but hopefully the random reboots have stopped. They stop plus for a while, then they start up again. So it's been exciting to say
I did some of my first testing with DirectX 12 and Windows 10 this week as well, which we'll talk about a little bit later, actually. So yeah.
As tempting as it is to talk about software on a hardware show, we should probably delve right in. Do you want to start with the Dell XPS 13 notebook review of something we were both really excited about at CES, or the Silverstone Fortress FT05 enclosure of doom?
Well, let's mention that case real quick. It's real easy to talk about, right? Silverstone is known for their kind of 90-degree rotated chassis, where all the components inside are rotated 90 degrees clockwise, so your graphics card points up instead of out the back of your system. Right. The idea is pretty simple. Heat rises. Why not make a case where all of the stuff is kind of exhausting heat up instead of exhausting heat out to the back of the case? And it's a good idea in practice.
It's physics.
it is. It's like science-y and stuff. That's one of the old cases we're showing a picture of there now, but it's the exact same design. Like, it's the same infrastructure in terms of how it works. But You gotta have the right hardware for it. Like if you don't, if you have a graphics card cooler like he does in this, you know, particular review setup that blows air inside the case as opposed to expels it out of it, you lose some of the benefits of that, right? So it's better to have a blower style cooler on your GPU than a kind of, I don't know what you call a non-blower style traditional heatsink type configuration. It's also an expensive case. It's like $175, but it's kind of an aluminum and steel combination.
Well, I mean, it's very stylish. The build quality is supposed to be superior to the Raven, the kind of the previous super cool, awesome design from Fortress. Sebastian points out, you know, that basically it's a quieter case. The material is much nicer, but you also, I guess, lose some capacity compared to the Raven. So you spend $50 more. The case is a little more quiet. The materials are a little bit nicer. You can fit less stuff in it, you know, or you get to do more of the case construction, like, you know, how do I get that thing over there thing?
That was fun.
Gold award, though. He was overall pretty impressed with it.
We actually had it here. You can notice that's our set in the background. It was one of the trips he made down here from Michigan. And I got to use the case. It's heavy. It feels high quality. It feels fairly strong. The internals, like the RV05 and the FT05, the Raven 05 and the Fortress 05, they're identical internally. But it's all the other stuff on the outside of it, whether or not you want like kind of plastic, curvy, angular stuff, or if you want flatter, you know, kind of aluminum, brushed aluminum feel to your case. But it's worth checking out the story if you're on the lookout for kind of a high-end, high-priced case, to be fair.
OCZ Vector 180 SATA SSD, full capacity, Roundup, Barefoot 3 M00 with PFM Plus, which is a mouthful. Alan wrote this up for PC Per, of course. OCZ, the SSD company that failed, and I'm not trying to be mean when I say that, purchased by Toshiba. And you can see in the first picture of the Vector 180 on there, powered by Toshiba NAND, a Toshiba Group company. So obviously, Toshiba's on the warpath to make sure people know that the power and might of Toshiba is behind this brand. Because people were astonishingly, incredibly, amazingly, and I think quite justifiably concerned about like warranties and some other stuff when the OCZ went down. So OCZ Arc 100, Vertex 460A, right in the middle there, the Radeon R7, the Vector 180, and the Revo Drive 350, and that SSD comparison. This is a pretty broad range of products, to say the least.
They've got a lot of stuff on their table there, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, so most of those are using the OCZ Barefoot 3 M10 controller, a notable exception. The M10, the M10, the M0, the M0, and then the SandForce 2281 at the Revo Drive 350, which is pricey. That's a $830, 960 gigabyte part at the high end. How did it compare? I mean, I know Alan's still pretty bullish on the 850. There's been some pretty impressive, I was going to say badass, but that works too. Drives out from a couple of other vendors lately. How's OCZ? I mean, how is Toshiba's revival of the OCZ brand going?
So this is not the drive that's going to do it, at least according to Apple. This was kind of the attempt to be a new flagship product, and it has kind of all. If you look at the spec sheet and you look at the performance, you know, up to 550 read, up to 530 megabytes per second write. It has all the specs to do it. And if you just kind of look at your average numbers and you look at like just a normal round of benchmarks, and you know, you don't kind of really really dive into stuff, it would be easy to assume that this is just going to be, well, it's an SSD. It's a good SSD. It's reasonably priced. It should be successful. I guess I'll say the most important page though is, I think it's like the fifth or sixth page. It's called Trim Performance and Write Holding. And there were some oddities with the drive that he kind of noticed early in testing. They delayed the launch a little while, gave us a new firmware. We tried again, had similar or same results. You know, we tried to work with them to fix this before at least they ended up kind of going out with what they had. And there's two issues that crop up that are likely related. One is trim performance. The idea of trim is simple. When you delete something on an SSD, it has to like update metadata on the drive to kind of say, okay, these flash cells are now empty, right? So that's how it knows that the data there is gone. And that's like, you know, Windows sends a trim command back, SSD interprets it, moves on. The trim commands take much longer than any other SSD that we've tested here. And it's most, you know, the most apparent location is like, so if you've got a drive that's nearly full and you try to format it, which is deleting everything, and then it has to send trim commands all the time through that. It takes about 4 minutes to format this drive, when most other SSDs doing a quick format will take like 4 to 10 seconds, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a huge deal necessarily, because you're not going to format a drive very often. But what is a big deal, if you scroll up just a little bit to that, there's like a red line HD graph. Yeah, that right there. So that's a full write across the SSD. And what you notice there, the dark red, that kind of looks like you're in a prison cell type of thing, but those are all you're going performance across the top. So you're hovering around what should be about 455 megs per second, but you get these dips down. And the dips down are very regular. They're very repeatable. They're about every 20 seconds. And what happens is about every 20 seconds when you're writing to the drive, it just kind of stops for a second, like literally 1 second. So if you're copying a, 10 gigabyte or 20 gigabyte like game image over from your external drive to your SSD, or from your network drive to your SSD or something like that, even not at maximum speed, like 100, anything about 150 megs or above, you're going to notice every 20 seconds you get this pause that freezes all SSD activity to the drive for 1 second, which can be a pain in the butt, right? And it's not something we've ever seen before on another SSD. So, OCZ claims, what OCZ tells us is happening is that in that 1 second, it is doing it is updating its metadata mapping table and flushing the entire table out of DRAM and into the NAND flash, during which IO throughput is impacted for very brief periods, which is exactly what we're seeing, which in and of itself doesn't sound horrible, but no other SSD has ever exhibited this behavior when we're doing copy tests to it. And as you go up the capacity range, the issue becomes worse. It takes longer for these things to happen at 960 gig, then they do it 480, then they do it 240, because the mapping table is larger, right? It's twice as long on a 960, or twice as big on a 960 than on a 480. So the issue kind of gets worse as the capacity goes higher, and to a point where one of our just kind of plain DOS-based Windows file copy tests, the 240 performs at X level. The 480 is worse than that. And the 960 performs worse than that. And it's kind of a disappointing issue, right? We think they can fix this, but we're just kind of waiting to see. The other drives in their line don't really have the problem to this degree. So the other products are still pretty good, and maybe this one will be eventually. But right now, I don't think it didn't get Alan's vote of recommendation, I would say.
Ow.
To say the least. Yeah. Yeah, it happens.
I know, but it's just it's a big relaunch for a brand. Sorry, Toshiba. Do better.
Indeed.
Intel Micron announced 3D. My eloquence has been completely lost this week. It has been a week of randomly crashing systems and pain. So my sympathy for a launched product that could be better apparently is at an all-time low.
I can understand
Intel Micron.
That.
Yeah, no, I know you can. You've been there, sir. You have felt this pain. Intel Micron announced 3D NAND production with the industry's highest density, greater than 10 terabytes on a 2.5-inch SSD. If you're not excited about this, I don't know what your damage is on my lack of sympathy. My lack of sympathy bend, I guess, this evening. So it's interesting. So their 3D NAND is a little bit different from others. Sebastian wrote this up on PCPer.com. Quote, the implementation of floating gate technology and unique design choices has produced startling densities of 256 gigabit MLC and a whopping 384 gigabit with TLC. This is really interesting because this technology is going to allow greater than 10 terabyte capacities inside of a standard 2.5-inch SSD form factor, 3.5 terabytes on M.2 form factor drives. This is awesome. Five packages of 16 stack dies with 384 gigabit TLC. We're talking about greater than 3.5 terabytes. So what's interesting also is that apparently it's not, it's funny. Sebastian points out that Intel didn't comment on this, but they said they could be using roughly equivalent to 50 nanometer flash with this new 3D NAND, so that it wasn't actually a die shrink, although it seems like Intel was kind of just not talking about that. But the flip side of that is like a larger process in this case, 50 nanometer MLC, could it give increased endurance? You know, Sebastian also notes that Toshiba just entered the space, announced their 48 layer, 128 gigabit density 3D NAND. It like Samsung moving away from floating gates. So it's kind of an interesting split in the industry with Micron and Intel going one direction and Toshiba and Samsung kind of going in another. They're going to be expensive out of the gate, but I am thrilled with the idea of having a freaking 10 terabytes.
Your new coworker over there at Tested will sent me a tweet asking, like, when are we actually going to see 3.5 terabyte M.2 drives exactly?
Several years from now.
I don't think it'll be that long. I think that it'll be 2016 that you'll start to see this technology, right? Because I mean, this is just a technology announcement, but again, it's using older technology, like older process tech, so it should not be a large ramp up. It will be expensive at first. But I mean, the main driver of 3D NAND is higher density, lower cost, right? That's what happened with the 850 series from Samsung. The Samsung 850 SSDs use 3D NAND and they're high performance, high endurance, lower cost. So I expect Intel and Micron to kind of push forward on this faster than maybe you would normally see because of the lead that Samsung already has and the kind of increasing competition in the 3D NAND field. So I think probably by 2016, you'll start to see consumer grades integrations of this. Maybe not up to the 10 terabyte or 3.5 terabyte implementations, but
even if it was a mere 5 terabytes,
you'd take it, wouldn't you? Yeah.
I'd take it with a smile on my face and a song in my heart. At least if they could keep it, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the initial pricing is like and how fast it does or does not scale. But part of their approach to this is trying to use, you know, a relatively proven technology that's not going to cost them a fortune to bring online. I'm excited. To say the very least, I want a 10 terabyte, 2.5. Yeah. I mean, anybody who works with video, I would like my entire video collection on my laptop everywhere I go. That would be a little bit nuts. One last story before we take a break to thank our friends over at IT Pro TV. The XPS 13, the Dell laptop that was thoroughly fondled by Ryan, myself, and pretty much everybody that carries a laptop for a living at CES this year. I'm using the previous model, like the 2013 XPS 13, which is held up really, really well. If you're looking at that picture right now, a couple of the big features, I guess they were calling it the Infinity Screen because there's such a tiny bezel around it. That is a fantastic keyboard, an excellent mouse. The thing is ridiculously small. Ryan, what did the benchmarks reveal, especially in the battery life tests?
Yeah, you know, the benchmarks themselves aren't super impressive in terms of like CPU performance, GPU performance. It's a Broadwell part. We kind of know it's 10% faster or so than Haswell. So if you have a Haswell Ultrabook, in terms of performance upgrades, you're not going to get a whole lot out of it. The battery life is where I was really impressed. Our battery life is fairly intense. So when I say we got 7 hours and 57 minutes of Wi-Fi testing.
12 hours for the rest of the planet.
Right. It doesn't just that metric alone doesn't really mean much. But we tend to set our brightness a little bit higher than others do because I kind of pick something that I think is realistic. But if you compare it to, a ThinkPad X1 Carbon last year's Haswell version, that got 5.5 hours. In our test. So you're looking at a difference of almost 2.5 hours of battery life or, you know, 40% battery life, if you want to look at it that way, improvement on the Dell XPS 13. Now, the Dell XPS 13 has the benefit of, well, it's interesting because it has a 52 watt hour battery, so it's fairly big because the components inside the device are now smaller, so you can fit a bigger battery. But what's important to note is that one that we tested is the 1080p screen, the 1080p non-touch screen implementation on it, which I actually prefer. The other option is the 3200 by 1800 glossy touchscreen implementation, which looks, I mean, I will admit it looks better because of its higher pixel density. You have more issues with program application text scaling and whatever, but it looks amazing. The problem is battery life on that model, the higher resolution model, is actually significantly lower than the version you got here because the GPU is responsible for pushing out, you know, more than twice as many pixels every time it updates the screen, right? It's using more memory bandwidth that way. It's using more GPU horsepower when it does that, even in like just basic Windows applications. So driving more pixels costs more power. And already, I think it's a 13.3-inch screen and it's a 1080p resolution. It's already kind of like right on the edge of, do I need to enable Windows scaling or not? And I kind of felt like I did. It's about 125%. 3200 by 1800, you definitely have to. But it still takes more juice out of it than you would expect. And then, like, you look at something like the, so compare it to the Yoga 3 Pro from Lenovo that is not a Core i5 Broadwell. It's a Core M Broadwell, so the lower power processor. But it also has a 3200 by 1800 resolution screen, and its battery life was about 5 to 5.5 hours as well. So even though it's using a lower power processor, the Dell XPS 13 had significantly better battery life because of the screen resolution change. So something to keep in mind when you're looking at these specifications is a better screen doesn't necessarily mean that, well, I'm just going to get better pixels. It may have effects in other areas. But otherwise, the laptop was awesome. Like, it's not as thin as a MacBook Air, but that super that bezel is just impressive looking when you mm-hmm. see it. I actually just shipped this back today, and I was very disappointed that I had to ship it back today. I would probably have converted to that from my Lenovo X230 that I use now. But I am expecting we're getting in the new X1 Carbon from Lenovo, mm-hmm. the Broadwell version of that, I think tomorrow. So we'll see how that compares to this, because that's kind of like the direct competitor, I believe, to the XPS 13. But you used it too. It's an incredible laptop, and the model I reviewed was only $899, right? 4 gig, 128 gig SSD.
I mean, one, at $899, it's incredibly affordable for what you get. Two,
I think so.
I definitely would suspect that you're going to be buying a new laptop as soon as you've gotten your hands on the Lenovo. One of those two is going to be your next laptop. I would be shocked if you didn't.
The only other one that's up in the air is Lenovo. They showed at CES the LeVZ. Do you remember that one? That was like made out of that magnesium polymer body.
Oh, the one that's like sub 2 pound. And
when they handed like it to me, you thought it was empty. Like, there's no hardware in here. Yeah. That one, I just kind of, I think it might be too light. Like, it's something that might get lost in your backpack almost. it was definitely interesting. I think that's supposed to be a May release. So we'll check that one out too.
It's a good year for notebooks or laptops, whatever you want to call them. And I actually got to say, I'm even kind of excited about the new Apple MacBook, mm-hmm. possibly because for some reason I'm suddenly feeling a profound urge to have a gold laptop that I've never had before.
You're not the only one I've heard say that. Not the only one.
I've never gold phones. No interest in a gold phone. Gold laptop, highly amusing for reasons I can't explain. What is not hard to explain is why you should be checking out IT Pro TV. If you haven't, we should point out they're a sponsor of the show. They do good stuff. They're a video network dedicated exclusively to the world of IT, information technology. Whether you're looking to jumpstart a career in IT or you're in the field and looking to level up, IT Pro TV supplements traditional learning methods in a fun and engaging way. They're basically trying to maximize your learning and get you ready for the certification exams. They have hundreds of hours of content, 30 new hours being added each week. They have the courses they have available are basic. Goodness. Speaking, apparently my issues with Windows Technical Preview have extended to my own brainstem, and it's all going down. IT Pro TV, they do live streaming of classes, and of course they're available on demand worldwide. And what's really cool is it's not just you have to have, you know, your desktop, your laptop in front of you, because they'll run on Roku, Chromecast, your phone. They're good to go across a whole bunch of platforms. Video courses on Apple, Microsoft, Cisco, A+, CCNA, Security Plus, MCSA, CISP, PowerShell, Linux Plus. Specific covering of topics like network security, Linux, Windows, OS 10 support for desktops and servers. They're basically trying to bring experts in the field who are engaging and fun and thoughtful together with students, right? They've got their measure up practice exams are included. Virtual machine sandbox lab environments are set up so you can basically get hands-on without having to have a bunch of pain and trauma in your own personal life. It's smart. It's really cool. And it's not that expensive if you compare it to the cost of a study guide. It's way cheaper than going to an IT boot camp. You can interact with the hosts via chat during the live shows. There's web-based Q&As specific to study topics. You know, and even if you're staying with a book or you've already got a certification or technical degree program that you're working on, the idea is that they want you to think of this as a supplement to learn at your own pace and also measure and track your progress and manage your learning. They do corporate and group pricing. Their clients are pretty prestigious, including HP, UCSD, Stanford, MIT. You may have heard of those last two, Stanford and MIT. This is a solid program trying to help IT professionals get ahead and stay ahead. We think you should check out itpro.tv/twitch, because if you do, you'll not only get to upgrade your brand with the most popular IT certifications recognized by employers, but you get a really fat deal. The subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 for the entire year, but you'll not only get a free 7-day trial when you sign up using the offer code TWITCH30, which will let you check out the courses, live stream, and more for free. You'll also receive 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your account. That is less than $40 a month or $399 for the entire year. And if you're on the edge, starting this week, IT Pro TV has Sean Philip Oriano as their subject matter expert for Certified Ethical Hacker, which is their most requested course to date. Sean is an expert in many areas of security, and he literally wrote the book on CEH. His teaching and consulting experience includes both enterprise and military clients. He knows what he's talking about. They're streaming live this week and next from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday, April 3rd. IT Pro TV's live stream is available to everyone, even if you've just signed up for a free basic account. They hope you'll join them for 2 weeks of certified ethical hacking. And if you want to try that first week for free, do us a favor. Support our sponsor, itpro.tv, by going to itpro.tv/twitch and entering that offer code TWICH30, T-W-I-C-H 30. itpro.tv/TWICH. Use the code TWICH30 to try it free for 7 days and save yourself 30% for the life of your subscription. How cool is that, people? Yeah. And we want to thank them for sponsoring this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. So, speaking of software on a hardware podcast, graphics requires... Well,
it's very important software, though.
Yes. You need games to make your hardware do cool things, your GPU, and you need DX12 in the future. It is the future of Windows gaming. You have been benchmarking DX12, Mr. Shrout. Thumbs up or thumbs down?
Well, so it's a thumbs up. It's actually a very impressive technology, but I will say that when you go, if you go to PCPro.com and you look up the story, the 3D Mark, it's actually a part of the 3D Mark that actually just got released today called the API Overhead Feature Test. And they're very particular about not calling this a benchmark, because what they don't want you to do, apparently, they don't want you to compare GPU to GPU. Don't run this test and say, oh, look, NVIDIA is better than AMD, or this GPU is better than this GPU, because things are still early. What they wanted you to look at is how does, on the same system, does DX11 perform against DX12, perform against, you know, DX11 single threaded, right? And so the results are actually pretty impressive. So we tested the GTX 980 and the R9 290X, and you go from the best case scenario in DirectX 11 being able to handle 2.75 million draw calls per second. Draw call is simply the CPU asking the GPU to do something, to render something onto the screen.
And that's that's crazy 8-core system.
Right. This is an 8-core with hyper threading on. Yeah. The 5960X, the best you can do. With DirectX 12, we saw that hit 15.6 million. So from 2.7 to 15.6. Right, that's a huge increase. And as you look across it, like even we did some testing with 1-core, 2-core, 4-core, 6-core to kind of say, okay, here's kind of a generic way of looking at a bunch of CPU performance options. In like, if you have a two, like the 2-core option goes from 1.27 to 7.32 million. Right, so you're talking about a 6 to 7% increase on a dual core system that we configured, you know, through disabling cores in the BIOS, right? So, you know, the AMD results are very similar, with a little bit of an interesting twist there that Mantle is actually a little bit faster than DirectX 12 in this case at this point. But that kind of makes sense because Mantle was designed specifically for their hardware, whereas DirectX 12 has to be a little bit more agnostic in terms of how it works. The only other interesting thing that's worth pointing out is we took a GTX 980 and a GTX 960, very different cards in terms of actual gaming performance.
Right.
And we compared them against each other and we overclocked the 960. And as it turns out, like a slightly overclocked, like a good overclock, but not an amazing one, overclock on the GTX 960, the result on DX12 is almost the same as the 980, which is interesting in that it indicates to us that Indeed, this feature test should not be used to compare GPU to GPU, because no one in their right mind would say that the 980 is going to be on the same performance level overall as a GTX 960, even if it's overclocked. But in terms of DirectX 12 kind of draw call capability, the two platforms are very similar based on that CPU bottleneck. So really interesting stuff. This looks like it's going to open up the avenue for game developers, just as AMD has been saying that would happen with Mantle. But with DirectX 12, it's going to happen to everybody, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be a universal uptick. And, you know, at GDC, we got to see a couple of like kind of early examples of what game engines that are using DirectX 12 can do differently than what you could do with DirectX 11. And it's pretty cool stuff. So I'm optimistic that middle of the year, when Windows 10 and DX 12 are kind of fully released, that it will look up. We won't have games then, but we'll have the knowledge of what's coming, I guess, which is a good thing.
Be laid.
Well, exactly. I mean, you're excited about this.
Well, no, I mean, it's funny because I've been, you know, listening to you, and we've been talking about this over the last, I don't know, year. It seems like longer. I couldn't have been, but obviously we knew DX12 is coming. But it's funny. It's a large part of the issue with gaming performance has been essentially that DirectX has become the bottleneck, right? DirectX was originally put in place to standardize the way Windows, developers of games dealt with Windows, because there were too many, you know, back in the Windows 98 days, which feel so long ago when I say 98 out loud, 16 years ago, Windows 95 days, goodness, which is closing in on 20 years ago. But there was such a rat's nest of programming hacks and tweaks that were the heart of DOS gaming, that was the heart of essentially Windows gaming at that point. PC gaming might be a more accurate description. DirectX 1, the original DirectX, kind of changed everything and made it much, much easier to actually play games on PCs in general, and Windows in particular. So it's interesting that, you know, now almost 20 years later, they're trying to get the developers closer to the hardware. And it looks like it's doing really, really cool things.
Yeah.
I'm excited. Hey, you know what? My mood is turning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm almost feeling sympathy for the OCC relaunch. Not quite, but close. SEC filing reveals NVIDIA now using Samsung for some manufacturing. This, you know, it's kind of funny. Like, this is almost like it is fundamentally financial news, right? Because it's the Security and Exchange Commission. And I do love Sebastian's lead on that. Want to liven up your weekend? Forget college basketball. We all know that few things are more exciting than SEC filings. And boy, oh boy, do we have a great read for you. I mean, this is pretty interesting. So I won't get into the finer points of what a 10K filing is and what the SEC does, but essentially it's a public corporation disclosing information to the public as part of being a lawful corporation acting in the United States. I've probably gotten that wrong already. But Samsung is now making chips instead of TSMC. Is this a capacity issue? Is this TSMC having problems shrinking process? Or Sebastian points out, you know, back in December, NVIDIA was accusing Samsung of IP theft. and then points out that's ironically true. You know, Apple and Samsung are you know, have their hands around each other's throats, but Apple's still using Samsung for production of systems on a chip.
What's interesting about this is that there's really not a lot of information. We assume that they're referring to like 16 nanometer, 14 nanometer FinFET. We don't know if they're referring to GPUs or Tegra, SoCs. We assume it will be both, because we still assume that everybody's kind of skipping the whole 20 nanometer generation for GPUs because they don't offer any advantages in terms of either power scaling or frequency scaling. Mm-hmm. So we think that this is actually I believe it will encompass both the GPU and mobile side, which is interesting because it's kind of TSMC has been the go-to, you know, group there for a very long time for any kind of GPU technology that AMD and NVIDIA have built. They're still using 28 nanometer TSMC on all the current parts, but it's always interesting where you find these little bits of information, right? A form that NVIDIA has to fill out because of a Securities Exchange Act of 1934 revealed for sure some information about where they're going with their production planning in 2016. So
right.
Unintended consequences.
I'll be curious to see whether or not NVIDIA ever openly answers any additional questions about that relationship. My bet
it will have to eventually financial restrict, you know, the way the Security Exchange Commission works, like they have to eventually. But I'm sure they're not super happy about it. They know, you know, they're not super stoked about Samsung, I think, on a daily basis, but you got to get the chips made, right?
Probably not as unstoked as TSMC is right now, because I would assume that NVIDIA is a fairly large client of theirs. I could be wrong.
No, but, it would not be.
I don't know. That would be funny if it's a strategic move for NVIDIA to try to leverage against TSMC to get a better rate on processor production or something. Mm-hmm. To hell with you. We're going to Samsung, which is that's brinksmanship, people. The enemy of my enemy is my friend when I need a lower price or a better process. Who knows? We wait with bated breath. We do not, however, wait for bated breath. We do wait for bated breath for the next shipment from Harry's. I have been using their shaving cream for a while, and I really, really like it. I probably shouldn't actually call it shaving cream because it's more of a gel than a cream. Mm-hmm. In any case, if you haven't heard us talk about Harry's in the past, both Ryan and I have been using Harry's razors. People who know me know that I hate shaving. I have the thinnest hair in the like on the planet on the top of my head, but my beard is like little tiny redwood trees. It's a nightmare. I can't use an electric razor. You know, shaving isn't fun. I hate buying razors at the store, especially, you know, not too far from my house. They basically lock all the razors up in this sort of plastic fortress. It looks like it was designed by somebody who was working for Darth Vader. They're expensive. Even if you're buying like 30 at a pop at Costco, it's ridiculous. It's easy to pay as much as $4 or $5 a blade if you're getting a fancy razor, which is part of why Ryan and I are excited that this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is also brought to you by Harry's. It's really cool. They give you high quality razors, about half the price of the big brand blades, and they send them to your house. Right? German engineering. Their factories in Germany, they engineer them for sharpness and high performance. They ship them to you for free to your front doorstep or your mailbox or your office. Send them wherever you want them sent. It's really simple, right? They make and ship their own blades. They give you factory direct pricing. It's an efficient model. They guarantee your satisfaction. And, you know, if you want, they will send you a kit. It is pretty cool. The kit has all the products in a box. You can see them right there. The Truman set, the Jimmy Chin shave set, the Winston. I think the Winston might have been my first one. You know, but they've got the shaving gel. They've got the razor handle, razor blades. It comes in a really nice box, which my wife thought was very attractive, which is probably the only time she's ever complimented me on any razing gear I've had or shaving gear I've had. And the Truman set is a really good deal. You get all the gear in the box for $15. It's a nice shave. I really like the shaving gel. I like the look and feel of the set. It's stylish, not in the sort of like space anime razor manufacturer of doom, but in the way of like, it's a little more sophisticated. I'm going to say that. And you get a clean, close, and comfortable shave. They cost about half as much as the razors in the store. And Harry's wants you to know about a new aftershave moisturizer that protects and hydrates your skin. I have not had a chance to use the new aftershave yet, but if it's half as good as the shaving gel, it will be a staple in my bathroom. If I have enticed you to check out Harry's.com, do us a favor. Use the purchase code Twitch, T-W-I-C-H. You get $5 off your first purchase, and you're going to be helping support the podcast. Harry's.com, enter in the code Twitch at checkout. We want to thank Harry's for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. See? It's orange. It's stylish. It doesn't look like an anime space gun. It's nice occasionally to have things in the bathroom that don't look like anime space guns. Which probably has a lot of people wondering just exactly what I keep in my bathroom.
I'm not going to ask.
Oh, my goodness. It's not nearly as dramatic as it sounds. Corsair releases Dominator Platinum DDR4 3400 megahertz memory kits. The times, ladies and gentlemen, they are changing. Skylake is coming. DDR4 will be everywhere by the end of this year. If you are one of the rare motherboard owners that is in need of the DDR4 memory now because you are at the bleeding edge, these things are gorgeous. Jeremy wrote this up for PCPro.com. $1,000 for RAM. This is the Dominator Platinum Series, 16 gigabyte DDR4 3400 megahertz kit. It now has the world's record for the fastest overclock at 4,365.6 megahertz. That was on a Gigabyte X99 system on a chipboard. SoC board. Sorry. I see SoC as a system on a chip. It's a problem. You know, these are pretty crazy. That's part of the liquid nitrogen overclocking lifestyle that made that happen. But these are beautifully manufactured sticks of RAM. Or I should say at least their heat sinks are. The rest of the RAM pretty much looks like RAM.
I love me some Corsair. They're one of my favorite companies in this enthusiast. I cannot imagine spending $999 on memory. On 16 gigs of memory.
I'm laughing because I'm pulling up a camera that is not actually connected to my computer right now. Because I'm like, oh, look, Corsair Value Select in that computer right there. There's Corsair memory in that computer over there. You know, this one, I mean, this is kind of delightfully ridiculous. I mean, there's a light pipe. You can change the top bar out.
You can get that same you can get that same memory. Like, if you like the colors and the lights and stuff, way cheaper than that. You're not going to get the guaranteed 40, what is it? Guaranteed to be 3,400. Like, that's what it's rated at. And then they're showing it overclocking to something like 4,300, which is insane. But I also think the price is insane. I don't know. Like, you could buy a Titan X.
You wouldn't pay extra for it. Yeah. And that's, I mean, you know what? There's a half dozen people on the planet that can actually push this memory.
Right.
And they probably already have this memory in their pocket. And, you know, Ryan's going to remind you, spend your money properly.
Yeah.
you know, good, some people, good for some Corsair.
People, hey, you know, some people buy $1,000 Intel processors. Like, I get it. Like, I know that those groups are out there. And this is aimed at that group. So it's not like they're only offering DDR4 in this price level or something like that. It's just, woof. I'm going.
Well, congratulations to HiCookie for setting the world record for fastest DDR4. You know, the vicious part of me that apparently is surfacing again after my joy over the RexLex 12 is wondering how many of these memory kits he went through to get to that, or did like they just send him one and that was the result he got with one and a bottle of liquid nitrogen. I don't know. You know, if you want to spend the money, it's there.
Nice.
I'm like looking at this machine next to me, and you could buy 2.5 of these machines and still have like money for gum left over. Oh, wait, I could buy this laptop and a memory upgrade and be able to buy a cheeseburger and still have like $80 in my pocket. I don't know. It's nice that they did this. Everyone should have a completely ridiculous option.
They should have options for everybody, including those people with too much money.
Yes. MSI unveils the first AMD AM3 Plus motherboard with USB 3.1.
Yeah.
I think that pretty much says it, man. Tim Very wrote it up for PCPro.com. It's interesting. 2 PS2 ports, 6 USB 2.0, 2 USB 3.1, gigabit Ethernet, 6 analog audio ports if you want to pop this directly into the back of your amplifier. It's interesting that they're doing USB 3.1 on an AMD platform. I thought that was interesting.
This is on the AMD 970 chipset. So it's not the flagship chipset. This motherboard's going to be under $100. It's a little bit – so this chipset's pretty old. It doesn't have USB 3.0 support on it by default, right? So you get USB 3.1, but you don't get USB 3.0. So you get two USB 3.1 that are backwards compatible to USB 3.0, but the other six USB ports are all USB 2.0. Now, that's probably not a big deal for most people. Two USB 3.1 or 3.0 ports is probably plenty for how we use it, right? Your mouse and keyboard, they don't need USB 3 or 3.1 or anything. But it's cool to see already USB 3.1 being implemented on like low-cost budget boards, sub-$100 motherboards. And that bodes well for adoption rate, I guess, right? You look at the MacBook, the new MacBook. You look at the Chromebook Pixel, right? They're using Type-C connectors, not necessarily USB 3.1, but Type-C connectors, and you've got USB 3.1 showing up at different locations on the enthusiast side, and you can see where these things are going to merge, and there's going to be wonderful USB 3.1 glory with Type-C connectors and 10 gigabit per second performance, backwards compatible, all that stuff. I
think I hope is the operative one there. It would be nice. It would be nice for the, I think it's going to be a lot of hard drives and a couple power supplies just that companies build just to tick off Apple. But I don't know. Now it's I just keep thinking, Silver Lake, Sky Lake. I've been mistaking the name of Intel's next processor.
They're not the best at making their code names like decipherable to an outside person. To me, it's like looking at the Infiniti car lineup or something where I just don't follow it. So I see, oh, a Q65. I assume that those indicate certain things about a car. Like the BMW fashion makes sense to me. Right. Infiniti and Lexus don't make any sense to me. But you'll figure it out eventually. Skylake is the next CPU architecture after Broadwell. That's the one you're referring to.
Yeah. That is the one I'm referring to. Shannon was actually howling on the tech thing set this week. She's like, well, what is, Silver? I was like, I think it was calling it Silver Lake. And I'm like, well, I think it's a part of Los Angeles. She's like, you're dark. And I'm like, yes, I know. And no, it's funny because I'm actually, I think it's going to be really interesting to see the performance on Skylake. And now I'm sitting here and I was like really thinking about getting a new CPU. And now I really want to wait until October to see the benchmarks on Skylake, which, as you pointed out, is probably not going to be that much faster than Broadwell, but could be more efficient. So, bigger deal on laptops and desktops.
But. Correct. That would be my initial assessment based on what I know. Hopefully I'm wrong. Okay. Hopefully we get some like 9 gigahertz desktop parts. I don't know.
I don't think you're holding your breath on that one. Should we do one before we release you for the tip off? Should we do one question before we go?
Yeah, absolutely.
Huge fan of the show, writes Mike. I work from home and have a Windows 7 VM set up exclusively for work. Don't cross the streams. Normally, I would use it in full screen mode and activate the second monitor in VMware for a seamless full screen dual monitor VM experience. And this is actually an email from John about dual screen VMware boxes. I apologize for the confusion. Basically, he's looking for a seamless full-screen dual-monitor VM experience. This works well, he says, with my dual 2K Dell U271-1s and dual Radeon 280XSs. However, I just recently upgraded the dual 4K Dell P2715Qs, and I love them. It's a fantastic monitor. But the same full-screen dual-monitor mode in VMware Workstation 11 is unusably slow. Each card drives a monitor, and they are not crossfire. My host OS is Windows 8.1, and I have 64 gigabytes of DDR3 on an X79 motherboard. I've tried maxing out the VM's hardware specs, toggling graphics acceleration, allocating 2 gigabytes of video RAM to the VM, etc., but nothing seems to make a difference. The VM is running on an SSD and has 4 virtual cores and 16 gigs of RAM. Pushing it to 20 gigabytes did not help either. I've Googled this, and it doesn't seem like anyone's really doing dual monitor 4K in VMware. My question to you is, what exactly would I have to upgrade to get a seamless dual monitor 4K experience in VMware, i.e., what's my bottleneck? Oh, my goodness. have you ever seen 4K working well in VMware? Is the VMware tools driver itself even capable of pushing dual 4K reasonably quickly? And I think that last line is probably at the heart of this problem.
That would be my assumption as well. I kind of put this in here because I don't use VMware on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of systems that use it in different for file server hosting and whatnot. But I was kind of hoping somebody listening would have some answer. But that would be my guess too, is that something about the architecture of how VMware is working, mm-hmm. the amount of bandwidth required for 4K resolution is extreme, especially if you want to maintain color bit levels, like color depth quality and, high refresh rates. Because it's kind of like, I keep thinking back to, it's like, well, I remember when I would first do remote desktop stuff, and it would dip it down from, 16-bit color to 4-bit or 8-bit color, and you would have, the mouse would be running at 5 frames per second as you moved across things. It was a very poor experience. And I think that's probably what would have to happen to make it work now. I did a little bit of Googling and didn't see anything in particular about about that. I would say running 4K in VMware is probably pretty rare. I'd say it's probably pretty rare.
Well, it's funny because I think it is extremely rare because very few people have 4K monitors. And if they are, they're probably using it basically to jam code, not to try to run a virtual machine or display a virtual machine. But it was funny. I found like one post in the VMware communities forum, and it's all people trying to run Windows 10 full screen on a 4K monitor in VM. You know, Windows 8.1 and Windows 10. In one case, they had to turn off Accelerate 3D graphics. In the other cases, it was just abysmally slow. You know, it's kind of funny when we tell you that the only place anyone can really justify like a 1500 watt power supply is with their cross firing or you know, ganging up their NVIDIA GPUs because they have to feed such a ridiculous amount of pixels to a 4K monitor to get a decent gaming experience. The flip side is that means that even the relatively simple 2D stuff, which really isn't entirely 2D anymore, the Windows operating system, is incredibly stressful at 4K. It is four times the number of pixels. That is a snot lot of pixels, to use a highly sophisticated piece of technical language.
Somebody in the chat room reminded me, I don't know if what version of VMware he's running, GPU virtualization may be a feature that has to function in order for 4K to really work.
That's interesting.
And I know that is either coming in future versions of VMware or already exists in kind of like the higher end versions of it. But that may be the best bet, is to kind of do some research in that.
I would probably run it at 1080p and let your monitor scale it up, as painful as that probably sounds. But I just don't think that, you know, I think it, when the developers at VMware, and if I'm wrong, I apologize to everyone at VMware, but I'm pretty sure when they look at like the list of problems they have to solve, when you're looking at a tiny single digit percentage of market penetration on a particular product, unless that product is key to the future of virtual machines, it's probably really low on their list, and they're going to wait until a much larger group of people are complaining on the boards about the lack of 4K support.
Yeah, I would agree.
So maybe if everybody in the audience who has a 4K monitor goes to the VMware boards and dogpiles on that, they can help fix this problem faster. Possibly at the detriment to overall performance on VMware, but John, for one, would be delighted, and those Windows 8 and Windows 10 users. we should probably turn you loose so you can go watch Kentucky beat whoever they're playing into the ground. Should I ask who they're playing, or will you be able to restrain yourself?
They're currently beating West Virginia 16-2.
Wow.
So maybe we should keep
We probably should just keep the podcast going. Maybe that's why. I mean, that's a pretty serious...
I tell you what, when I go home, if at halftime the score is flip-flopped, I will come back to the office, I will call you, we will do a Skype call, and I'll stream it out. I'm that serious about this.
I played rugby for 9 years. I completely understand superstition in sports. That's why I mentioned it as an option. All right, we're going to turn Ryan loose. PCPro.com is the website to get Ryan Shroud's technical musings. He does not, however, spend a lot of time talking about basketball there. You can find me at techthing.com and the new possiblyunsafe.com. If you want to see people do streaming using a Raspberry Pi, turning a Raspberry Pi into a streaming Steam box, go check out possiblyunsafe.com. And thank you, each and every one of you, for listening. Hopefully, I will not be sweating quite this much next time you record the podcast. And hopefully, Ryan will be glowing with the victory over West Virginia. Go Kentucky.
If everything goes as planned, Thursday night will be my last night here, and then I'll drive to Indianapolis on Friday to prepare for a weekend of basketball, hopefully.
Basketball, people, not debauchery. Basketball.
Correct.
That's it for this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. Apparently debauched basketball fans don't have winning basketball teams.
It's true.
I don't know. There may be golf that weekend. We'll find out later. It's probably still freezing in Indianapolis. I'm doing this just because I want them to get a few more points before you tune in and the score starts going
down. Now it's a commercial, so I don't know what happens now.
We should probably get out while we can. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This Week Computer Hardware, you can find it at twit.tv/Twitch. You can email twitch@twit.tv. And, of course, we want to thank our sponsors and the entire Twit network who suffer with us each and every week. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shroud.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.